Think of all the college basketball players who dreamed that they would be the ones in the NCAA finals tonight. Players who have the talent, the drive, the coaching, and still don't make it. Mac Cleveland was one of these kids. In high school, he got recruitment letters from some of the best college teams. But when he looks back on that now, he says he had too much attitude. And word got out that the Cleveland kid, he was trouble.
You know, a lot started to go around that I was a head case, I wasn't coachable. You know, you could take a risk on a kid if you want. And so my recruitment was hurt.
Now the kid who wouldn't be coached does just that himself. Coach Mac Cleveland helps out other kids who were like him, kids like Ivan Johnson, who have too much attitude and loads of talent.
It's like, man, you're in the right place. You got the right people behind you. You got the right talent. You know, you're the right size. You're 6'8". It's everything I could have dreamed of being. You know what I mean? It's like everything I could have dreamed of being. To me, it was kind of like I was playing.
Living out the hoop dreams, one way or another. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
So now it's down to Memphis and Kansas. Players like Derrick Rose and Brandon Rush will step onto the basketball court in San Antonio this evening, fulfilling their dreams of playing in an NCAA final. Mac Cleveland will also be there, but he'll be sitting in the stands, watching. He's one of the thousands of basketball players who had that dream of playing top-level college ball and didn't make it. These days, Mac is a scout and a coach who works one-on-one with players who need help, and we'll meet one of those young men in just a moment. But first, Mac's story. See, Mac grew up in Chicago. His older brother was a good basketball player, and he and his friends would let young Mac join in, so Mac set his sights on a college scholarship.
I just dreamed of playing on ESPN and having Dick Vitale do my games more than I thought about being an NBA basketball player.
He's a coach's dream. You dream of having kids that can respond the way he does.
I thought it was all about getting to the NBA, all about, you know, scoring the big contract and getting the fancy cars, all that stuff.
Yeah, I never thought about money like that. I mean, I wasn't rich or anything like that, but my own passion, my own dream was, even to this day, I enjoy college basketball. I mean, anybody that knows me know I don't watch pro basketball until the playoffs, but college basketball, I don't miss a game. I mean, I'll watch Nicholas State versus Oklahoma Baptist. It doesn't matter. I love college basketball. So as a kid, I can't say that I didn't want to go to the NBA, but that wasn't my dream. I mean, that was just would have been the result of having a great college career. But, you know, my dreams and fantasies, they came in stages. You know, as an elementary school kid, I dreamed about being a high school basketball star. My brother raised me not to fear anybody. So, you know, as a freshman and sophomore, I played varsity basketball, and I would play against some of the top players in the city, in the country. And, you know, I would, you know, do well against them. And I would take on the challenge. I would try to guard them. I would try to shut them down.
Were you big? Were you strong? Could you manage these guys?
If you would have saw me in grade school, you would have never said, oh, this kid is going to need to lift weights. Like, I'm not a big guy statue-wise, but I've always had a nice physique. It's just genetics from my family. My father's a strong man. My uncle's a strong man. So, you know, you can look at the men in my family and see that the genetics are there. But my brother's upbringing, you know, with me and putting the mentality in my head that, you know, you have to show everybody up. And that's just the way my family is. You know, we want to show you up. We want to show we the best. So it don't matter who you are. You know, if your name's in the newspaper, I'm going for you. You know, I'm going for your head. You know, if you're All-American, I'm going for your head. I'm coming for your head. So, you know, I spent my junior high years reading about some of these guys in the newspaper, and I would have these guys' newspaper clippings on my wall. Mm-hmm. So there would be a little bit of starstruck, you know, ness, if you want to call it that. But the adrenaline inside of me was like, this is your chance to make a name.
Now, you did well in high school, right? You got the scouts paying attention. You actually, as you got to your senior year, you started to get letters, right? Recruitment
letters?
Yeah, well,
I got my first letters in eighth grade. I've got letters from Iowa, Illinois University, Michigan State, Arizona.
So look back with me, Mac. When did something start to go wrong?
You know, unfortunately for me, in grade school, our coach just kind of let us play. You know, we never learned plays. We never learned fundamentals in terms of team basketball. It was kind of like I spent the last 8 years doing what I wanted to do on the basketball floor, and now you're telling me that, you know, it's something I don't do well, or, you know, you don't go left well, or you're undisciplined, or that's a bad shot. Well, that was a shock for me. I just had the ability to score, so I felt like, you know, I really shouldn't have to run these plays.
Right.
You know.
Matt Cleveland left his first high school because of conflicts with the coach. At his new school, things weren't much better. One game, during his junior year, Matt let things get out of hand.
We were up maybe 12 or 15 points in the fourth quarter, where we had this one kid on our team whose mother always came to all the games, and she was one of the big supporters. And this kid threw the ball away like 7 times in a row, which actually turned into maybe like 14 or 18 points for the other team. So they end up winning the game. So we get back to the school, and the coach puts the tape on, and all the parents and all the supporters from our school is in the hallway, and he puts a tape on, and he turns to me and said, "I'm the reason why we lost." Well, you know, I wasn't going for it, so I cussed him out. I cussed him out well.
In front of the parents, in front of the other players?
I cussed him out in front of everybody that was there, because he tried to embarrass me in front of everybody that was there. So that's where that went.
I was going to say, this is never going to turn out well for the student who does that, right?
Yeah, well, that's what hurt me, because at the time I had a pretty good, nice position among rankings, and I think a lot of college coaches kind of backed off me then, because that was my second transfer in 4 years. You know, a lot started to go around that I was a head case, I wasn't coachable, you know, you could take a risk on a kid if you want. And so my recruitment was hurt.
Was there any truth to that when you look back on it now in the sort of cold light of day? Was that a reasonable thing to say about you, that you were a bit of a head case?
I wouldn't say I was a head case, but I wasn't very coachable.
Yeah.
I never believed that as a kid, you know, or as a young man, that me being a pain in the butt was going to hurt me recruiting-wise, because I figured, hell, I can play. Somebody's going to take me. You know, the school is still going to want me.
Well, some schools did, but none of the Division I powerhouses that had originally courted him years earlier. Matt Cleveland bounced from college to college, eventually graduating, but realizing that a pro career wasn't going to happen either.
I mean, I played in college, but it wasn't at the level that I dreamed about playing at, because I had shot myself in the foot so many times to get to that level. So, you know, I became a coach by default.
How did that happen?
I was supposed to go to China and Russia on an overseas basketball tour. And, you know, at that point, I just wasn't that interested in playing basketball to lead a country. To go to China and Russia, you know, I don't even eat Chinese food. I didn't know what I was going to do. I thought maybe I would coach a year, and then after practice, I would work on my game and stay in shape, but you know, I didn't realize coaching took so much, so the working on my game part just kind of went out the window, and, you know, we actually won the junior college state championship that year. So I got hungry to win again, and I've been coaching ever since.
You have to explain something to me, though. You were such a hotshot basketball player in your high school years. You didn't want to be coached. You didn't want to listen to a coach. And now you're a coach. How did you turn that around?
I understand players, and I understand players of this generation. Them knowing where you come from, them knowing that you, and them knowing and understanding that it wasn't that long since you played.
Yeah.
And you can run off examples of any situation, any issue that a player may have with a coach. You've been there, you've done that. But when you have talent, you have to let talent play. You know, I just feel like they have too many authoritative coaches out here that want it done only one way. And that's just not a good way to coach talented guys.
So I could send you 5 hard cases like young Matt Cleveland's, and you could turn that into a basketball team.
Yep. I tell you, 5 Matt Cleveland's is going to win.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As Mac was saying, he was still hungry for a title. So when his friend told him about a young prospect named Ivan Johnson, a player who was known for having loads of talent and lots of attitude, a player who was sitting at home waiting for a break, well, Mac was interested.
He was big, he was strong, he played, and I said, okay. He doesn't have much offense, but he rebounds the ball and blocks and dunks really well. So I can work with everything else. I'll be honest with you, I only remember working with Ivan on his shot maybe about 20 times. I mean, like I say, it wasn't even an everyday thing, but by December, he was shooting the basketball, turnaround jumpers, three-pointers. I mean, he's just a natural talent. I call him a freak, because he's a combination of speed, athleticism, talent that you just don't see every 5 years. By January, I knew Ivan was a pro.
The way that Ivan Johnson remembers it, he was one of these kids who grew too fast. He had no athletic skills in his younger years.
All through middle school, elementary, ninth grade, I was sorry, couldn't catch, couldn't shoot, couldn't do nothing on the court. I just hadn't caught up to my body yet, not really working on basketball.
How big are you?
270, 6'9".
And when you were in high school, how big were you then?
6'3", like 200 pounds.
And what was the moment, Ivan, I don't know if you can remember it, but what was the moment when you thought to yourself, this is my game, I'm good at this?
And I say about the 12th grade, when I started dunking on people.
And were you getting a lot of interest from college coaches at that point?
No, not really, because we wasn't winning. It was just me on the team. I mean, I had a couple of other players on the team, but they wasn't as good as me.
So what were you thinking was going to become of your basketball career?
I didn't really think nothing, no. I was just going to graduate high school and just get a job or whatever.
You weren't planning on going on to be a professional basketball player?
I was going to try, but it really wasn't too many schools looking at me.
What kind of job were you thinking you might get?
Driving an 18-wheeler or something.
And so who kept you working at basketball? What was it that kept you at it?
Seeing how my mama struggled all her life, I didn't want her to struggle no more. I didn't want her to work no more.
I mean, there's a lot of kids who see basketball as the ticket to a much more comfortable life. Are you one of those? Is that what you were thinking?
Yeah, because who wouldn't want to have a job that they like to go to every day?
Yeah, no kidding. What was your mother saying?
Don't be in the streets. Stay out of trouble. And that's the only way I can stay out of trouble is basketball.
But Ivan Johnson also ran into trouble when he was playing basketball. Trouble with coaches, with opponents, with his own teammates, and even with the fans. We'll talk more about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. For most basketball players and fans, this night of the NCAA final is the biggest night of the year. Basketball's elite will be there in San Antonio. For scouts and coaches and prospects and pros, it's a place to trade stories and to look ahead. Coach Mac Cleveland and the NBA prospect Ivan Johnson joined me from a studio there to talk about attitude. See, Mac says he had so much attitude as a player that he ruined his own chances, and now he's trying to make sure that young men like Ivan don't do the same thing. Ivan says that when he started playing, seriously, in high school, his mother was a great support for him.
She knew I was a talented kid, but she knew how my attitude was, so she never came to my games a lot.
She didn't come to your games?
Nah. I didn't have nobody coming to my games. I mean, I got used to it, so it really wasn't nothing.
You said that the reason your mother didn't come to your games was because of your attitude.
Yeah, she didn't like me cursing a lot, and that's what I used to do on the court.
Who were you cursing?
Just getting mad at myself, getting mad at my players, getting mad at the coach for taking me out, referees, everybody, people in the stands.
Was there any one particular incident that you can think of, Ivan? You look back on it now and you think, oh man, what was I doing?
Let me see. When I spit in the crowd, when I punched a hole through the wall in the gym.
So everybody was watching?
Yeah.
What did people say about you?
I was out of control. Wasn't coachable.
Were you out of control?
Yeah, I think I was. Because I was still growing up. I was still playing around a lot.
But you were a talented basketball player, right?
Yeah, I was. It was no doubt about that. But my playing around in school got in the way of my basketball. Dealing with the principals, dealing with the teachers, parent conferences, suspensions, all that.
What did you get suspended for?
Skipping school, cursing out teachers, fighting.
What was going on in your mind at that time? How come you had this really angry side?
I mean, it really wasn't angry. I just used to play around with a lot of people, and they'll get mad at me. And when they got mad at me, I'd get mad at them. That's when we'll be fighting.
But, I mean, you could have just walked away. You could have said, you know, I'm working on a basketball career. I'm not going to fight with you in the hallway. Go away.
No, I really wasn't that type of dude. I was a big bully in high school.
On the court? Off the court?
All the time.
You must have frightened some people, though, because if you're a big bully, you're also a big guy. You could scare somebody.
Yeah, all the time. I still frighten people today.
But that's a good thing, right? To frighten people today?
No, because when you've been frightening people for almost your whole life, you know, it ain't fun no more.
Huh. I would have thought you could make that work for you on the basketball court. People would stay away from you.
Nah, that don't work. Not on the basketball court. There's another dude out there that looks just as mean as you.
So Ivan Johnson got himself a reputation as trouble. He didn't get the college offers that he might have expected. And then Mac Cleveland found him. He brought Ivan to play at L.A. Southwest College, and Ivan says he found it easier to listen to Coach Mac than to other coaches.
I seen where he was coming from, and I knew he seen where I was coming from. So I looked at him as a big brother. You know, I was out there by myself, didn't have nobody out there but him. So I had to listen to him. You know, I talked to my mama on the phone every day. He talked to my mama every day. And shoot, they was both by my side, so I had to stick with the people that was by my side.
What were you thinking at this time, Ivan? Were you thinking that it's time to sit up, pay attention, listen to a good coach, and maybe this will be the moment when you make a breakthrough?
Yeah, I thought about it, but I was still in that playful mode. Still immature.
Did you guys ever clash? Did you guys ever disagree with each other on the basketball court?
Basketball was just, I mean, I knew when I came to a game, if my boy Ivan was there, I wasn't even worried about the game. I mean, Ivan dominated junior college basketball. It was fun to come watch. Like, I wouldn't even be coaching. I was an assistant coach. I mean, you didn't even have to coach. You could just sit there, and Ivan would play like 40 minutes a game. He would grab pretty much every rebound. I mean, he would block shots. He would dunk on people. He'd turn around and jump. I'm watching. You know, it's beyond coaching at this point.
Wait a second here, Mac. This guy has a reputation as a hard case, as someone who can't be coached, as someone with a temper, and you're describing him as the next Shaq or something. I mean,
well, this is the thing. Ivan was never uncoachable. Ivan's case was his temper and his attitude and character off the court. If you tell Ivan, run up the mountain, run up a 17,000 elevation mountain. If you made your whole team run a 17,000 elevation mountain, Ivan would be the first one up there. Everybody else would be whining and crying. Now, one thing about him is he's very outspoken, which a lot of kids are not. So if Ivan feel like that you're telling him something wrong, he's going to tell you. And a lot of coaches have problems with that. Now, the problem with it is how he tell you. You know, he may not tell you in a way that you're used to a 19-year-old telling you something, if a 19-year-old going to tell you something back.
Yeah.
He's going to tell you in a whole nother way. I might tell Ivan, you got to get back on defense. You know, Ivan might tell me, well, I'm back, but everybody else ain't back. So the way he's telling me, it doesn't offend me because we both fiery.
Were you guys working together at Los Angeles Southwest when Ivan got suspended during the playoffs? Were you guys together then?
Yeah, and that was probably like the first clash during the game. I kept trying to tell him, like, Ivan, do not say anything to the referee. He's going to tech you. You're going to get your second tech. And what ended up happening, he had already got the first tech from the same referee.
For cussing out the referee, right?
Right. So the next tech wasn't even really a big deal. I mean, Ivan didn't even say that to the ref. Ivan kicked the floor after getting fouled and falling.
Yeah, and I went up for a jump shot, and another guard came from my backside and undercutted me. And I hit the floor, and the dude, like, landed some kind of way under me, and they called a foul on me.
And let me just say, he was having the best game he's probably had the whole year. He had 28 points and about 14 rebounds, and it was still like 7 minutes to go in the game. And a referee teched him, and that was it. That was it. That was our chance to win the state championship. It just went out the door then. It was gone at that point.
That meant that you were out for the final game, right?
Yeah.
Which your team lost?
Yeah.
By
they
2 points.
They played hard, though. They only lost by 1 point.
By 1 point.
Yeah. I mean, it was hard to watch because I knew I was better than most of the players on the court. I mean, I knew I had messed up.
I read a quote from your coach at the time, the head coach, Reggie Morris, saying at the end of that second game, you were just crying in the locker room.
Yeah, because I knew I hurt the team and I hurt myself and I hurt the coaches. And I felt bad about it. I knew that they gave it their all on that court.
Yeah. And, Mac, what were you thinking at the time?
I was hurt, man, because I wanted to win that second state champ. We were so close. It was kind of one of those things where the team we was playing was seated higher than us, but they wasn't better than us. So it was one of those games where I was like, if we play San Bernardino Valley, we're going to blow them out because they have nobody to stop Ivan. That's all I kept saying. I think they threw a party when they found that Ivan was suspended for the rest of the season.
Mac, tell me something. Were you mad at Ivan at that time?
I was mad at Ivan at the game when he got thrown out. Yeah. I wasn't mad at him after the game. I was mad at that game because I had just told him, don't say nothing to the ref. When he got the first tech, I had just told him. I said, Ivan, don't say nothing to the ref. I had just told him that. We were just arguing about that. And he got the first tech. Had he listened to me and not got the first tech, the second tech would have never even happened. The second tech would have been a first technical.
Ivan, you were telling me earlier that your mother never came to any of your games. Was she at any of those games?
Nah, she didn't ever come because she didn't want to get on the plane. She was scared of planes.
Yeah. But she followed your career, right? She knew that that was a good year for you.
Yeah, she knew what I was doing because I called her every day and told her.
I would call her.
Yeah, Mac, why were you calling her as well?
Because I was my girl. You know what I'm saying? We had to work together to help Ivan. You know what I mean? She's the mom. I'm the brother. So, you know, some things that, you know, she may have to tell him that he'll listen to. And then there were some things that I may have to tell him that she wanted me to tell him that he'll listen because she knew that he would listen to me.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, we both was, you know, working on Ivan.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Ivan Johnson was a college basketball player struggling with the kind of attitude that might keep him from a pro career. Mac Cleveland was working as his coach and mentor. And while that season at LA Southwest didn't end well for the team, Mac was able to help Ivan make the jump from junior college to Division I play at the University of Oregon. One good season, they hoped, and then that crack at the NBA.
I thought that, wow, that the Pac-10 is not ready for Ivan Johnson. There was nobody strong enough, mean enough, tough enough to handle him. And that I just thought he was going to be 1 year and done.
Ivan, what did you think?
I mean, I thought it was 1 year and done, too. We started off the season good. I played good. Came on top 10 plays on ESPN. So I thought my season was going to take off from there.
Nothing brought me more joy than to turn the TV on and watch him play. You know, I remember his season starting on ESPN. He used to do the Midnight Madness for all the top programs in college basketball. And I remember racing the ESPN zone to watch it. And I was just so proud because we had been through so much to get him now. I mean, we went through the year, him being suspended, to him trying to get academically eligible. When I saw him on ESPN, man, I felt like I was out there.
It was almost as if it was too good to last. Ivan says he started getting in trouble again with the new coach, with the fans, even with his teammates.
Got late on into the season. Started getting into it with some of the players. I mean, in practice, I go hard. I go so hard, the other players will start going to the coaches after practice talking about I hit them too hard in practice. So I confront them about it. They say their little words. I say my words. And it might escalate from there.
Did you wind up in a fight with any of these guys?
Yeah, I fought one of them, but it wasn't really nothing. It was just pushing.
Yeah. Not great for team spirit, though, right?
Nah.
What happened next?
With me being so emotional, wanting to win all the time, wanting to be in the game situations. You know, when the coach would take me out, I'd get mad at that. And then when the referees would mess with me, you know, calling messed up fouls on me all the time, I'd get mad at that. Or whatever it was, how I was playing, I'd get mad at myself. And so then when the coaches is talking to me while I'm on the court, that'll make it get even worse.
You still didn't have this temper under control?
No, not really. I wanted to perform at my best, and I was messing up at it. So I'd get mad at myself, and it'd get even worse.
You're describing it like it's some kind of, I don't know, circle or spiral. It just, one thing goes wrong, and that leads to another thing going wrong, and you get angry, and then another thing goes wrong, and it just starts to get out of control. Is that a reasonable way of looking at it?
Yeah, that's the way.
Did you throw it away then?
Pretty much.
Oh, Lord. I was so bad at Ivan, I probably didn't talk to him for about 3-4 months. The whole year, Oregon, just, you know, I would call him and talk to him. I would come up there and see him. And I just felt like he just didn't understand what was at stake. He was just playing just because he had the opportunity to play.
But he had you there. He had you to grab him by the shoulders and give him a shake and tell him to get his act together.
Somewhere down the line, he wasn't listening to me no more. He just wasn't listening. And I'm trying to tell him, you know, kid, you throwing millions of dollars down the drain, man. You're going to have a job in a couple of years. You're going to work real jobs, man. You know, and somewhere down the line, he had just stopped listening, man. And it was just draining. I was coaching junior college down in California, and I had some more Ivan Johnsons I was working with. So, you know, I kind of needed him to be the example, be the success story. Like, you know, man, if Ivan can do it, I know y'all can do it. You know what I'm saying?
I got to tell you, though, Mac, as I listen to you describe your frustration with this young, talented kid, I'm hearing you describe yourself. Like, he could have grabbed it. He should have had it. He was the right age and the right place, and he didn't do it. And in a way, that's your story, too, isn't it?
Yeah, I was rolling with him. You know, to me, it was kind of like I was playing. You know what I'm saying? So, but he was in a driver's seat. You know what I'm saying? So, it's like, man, you're in the right place. You got the right people behind you. You got the right talent. You know, you're the right size. You 6'8". It's everything I could have dreamed of being. You know what I mean? It's like everything I could have dreamed of being.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. With Ivan Johnson squandering this opportunity at Oregon, I wondered if his former coach, Mac Cleveland, was ready to give up on him or on their friendship.
Never. What happened was it just became a distance in communication. And the purpose for that for me was for him to figure out things on his own. You know, like for 2 years, I had been picking up the pieces every time something fall apart for him. I was always there, you know, like, okay, this class is messed. Okay, we'll help you get another class.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? We'll help you study for this test. You know, we'll help you do this. You know, we'll help. I'll fix this. I'll fix that for the last 2 years. You know, I would do that. You know, so I felt like at that point, I was starting to do him a great disservice by always being there when stuff fall apart. You know, so what I did was I kind of just distanced myself from him and let him figure out basketball-wise, career-wise, whatever he wanted to do. I had to let him figure out how important it was going to be for him, you know, not me.
After a year at the University of Oregon, Ivan wound up at a Division II team playing with Cal State San Bernardino. And true to form, he brings his old attitude with him. This time, the coach wasn't having any of it. He benched him. And this time, it worked.
When I first got there, I was sagging my pants, playing around in the game, not listening. But I say like mid-season, I found out that we had a good squad, and then I knew we could make it somewhere. So I matured, like, I wouldn't say real fast, but I knew I was maturing and I wasn't playing around so much, so I could focus on my basketball. I got in the gym, got in the weight room, started running. So I got back to my old size. But when I first got down there, I was weighing like 300 pounds from not doing that while I was in Oregon. And got back down to like 260, 265. that's when it like really took off.
But Ivan Johnson has to be watching the clock. He knows that NBA scouts are looking at new talent that's coming around every year, and even players like him will get overlooked if they have a reputation. So we'll see where Ivan is now, in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. When the people who scout for pro basketball players go in search of new talent, they're looking at who's fast, who's big, who can jump, and who takes direction from a coach. Many of the best scouts will be in San Antonio, Texas for tonight's NCAA final. This hour, I'm talking with one player who's still trying to get noticed and the coach who's helping him. The player, Ivan Johnson, got as close as he was ever going to get to national attention when his team, Cal State San Bernardino, actually made it to the Division II Final Four in 2007.
Ivan Johnson, the spin move on the baseline. I think that's him saying, get me the ball. Ivan Johnson on the baseline, an emphatic stuff.
Success for Cal State San Bernardino, taking the ball hard to the basket.
Play and no good. Here comes Atkinson, had the game winner last night. To the hoop.
He's fouled
with 1.5 seconds. And the game is over, and Barton is going to the finals.
Ivan's team lost in the final seconds, but his performance that year earned him a spot in the NBA's development league called the D-League. So Ivan's now playing for the Rio Grande Valley Vipers. His agent says there's some interest in him from NBA teams, but it's hard to tell for sure. Ivan's continuing to progress, but he says things really changed after his mother passed away this past Thanksgiving.
I mean, I always told her that I'd make it just for her so she won't have to work no more. And by her passing, I told her that I promised her that I wouldn't quit, I wouldn't give up. So now, that's my main thing. I know she's watching me, so I gotta go hard.
So you're still doing it for her, right?
I'm doing it for her, my brother, my niece, my daddy. Because don't none of them people really got nothing right now. I'm the only person that can still do something. And if I don't do something, shoot, we going to be out on the streets.
That's a lot of pressure you're putting on yourself, Ivan.
Yeah, it is, but everybody faces pressure, man.
You still talk to your mom?
Yeah, I talk to her every day. Little stupid stuff I see in the streets. I laugh with her, talk with her. A pillow that she had in the house that she used to sleep on, I keep that with me all the time. Wherever I go, I keep her obituary with me. Just so I can see her face, so I won't forget how she looked. Before she passed, I got her face tattooed on me. So I'll never forget how she looked. And that means so much to me.
You're still just on that edge of success in basketball. And I wonder if it's any easier for you now that it's just you. I don't mean to suggest for a moment that it's a good thing that your mom's not around. Don't misunderstand me. I'm just saying that now it's just Ivan. And while you've got other family members that are depending on you, it's kind of up to you now.
I mean, I got to let all that other stuff go. As far as talking to the refs, complaining all the time, I just got to show my talent and show people what I can do. And so that I am coachable. I am a good player.
You've had a few chances to do that. Can you grab this chance?
Yeah, I'm going to grab it. I ain't going to let it go either.
I mean, I have to wonder about something. You're in San Antonio. You're going to be there when the stars of this year's college basketball teams are duking it out. These guys are younger than you. You're watching players who are 19, 20, 21 years old, and they're younger than you. Do you worry that maybe you missed your chance, or is it still there for you?
Nah, because I know I can go with the best.
No doubt in your mind?
No doubt.
There's no doubt about it, and this is no knock on anybody in particular in the NBA, but I was better than probably 20% of the guys in the NBA right now that's playing power forward. Basketball's no question. Hart's no question. He's ideally what you would want. If you were making an athlete in a laboratory, he's everything that you would put into an athlete to make him be a dominant basketball player.
Yeah, except maybe we could remove some of the temper.
Yeah, well, I'm saying minus that when I say physically. You know, when I say physically. That.
But let me ask you something, though, Mac. You've known this young man now for, what, 5 years? Pretty close to?
About four.
Four years now. And you've seen him at his very best. You've seen him at his lowest. You listen to him now saying, I'm ready. I have to be ready. This is my chance. Do you believe him?
Yeah, I believe him because he's totally different from where he was in college. One day I was watching their game on NBA TV, and didn't even look like the same person. I mean, you know, he was in shape, but I didn't see anybody arguing with the ref on every call. I didn't see a person throwing fingers at the crowd. I didn't see a person, you know, yelling at his teammates. And, you know, I just called him out to the game, and I was like, man, you look good, man. You know, you look like a whole totally different person. And I talked to him. He sounded like a totally different person. So, you know, I mean, it's just a maturity thing, man. You know, everybody mature at different stages. You know, life events, you know, makes us mature. So this is the crazy thing about it. In junior college or in college, if Ivan had woke up one day and said, man, I'm going to be the best player in the country, and I'm not going to have an attitude, I'm going to improve my character, he would have been the most talked about player in college basketball. That's without me being biased. Like, really. There was nobody in college basketball could stop him. He stopped himself. You know, so as long as Ivan get out of his own way, I've never had a doubt in my mind that he would be a basketball star in the NBA. I'm not talking about just a guy that's just there, you know, with a contract. I mean, he could be a star given the right situation.
Mac, you're a basketball player yourself who had a chance and missed it. You're now a coach. So I think you've got a pretty realistic perspective here. And you know, as I do, that the high school yearbooks of this country are full of photographs of young men who should have been NBA stars and didn't make it. I mean, how many chances do you get?
Well, you don't get many. You got to be blessed to get many past one, I should say. So, I mean, yeah, it differs, but I think where the line is drawn is your toughness, your mental toughness. See, Ivan has never been given anything in basketball. He never was a high school All-American. Nobody ever shipped him 1,000 pairs of shoes. Nobody ever bought him something to eat every day because he could play basketball.
Nobody put his picture on the cover of Sports Illustrated.
Yeah, so his mentality is a lot different from the guys that's coming out of high school and the guys that's coming out of college right now. They have to adjust to how Ivan is living, having to earn everything, having to earn a right for the NBA to call you up. So, you know, I feel like he's ahead of the game.
I'm going to give the last word to you, Ivan. What are you thinking?
I'm through with all that yelling and all that. That takes too much energy, messing with the referees. I send my energy to all, like, rebounding, hustling plays. I do everything on the court now. You know, I did everything in the past, but now it's like, forget 110%. It's like 150%. I go hard now. Leave the refs alone. I mean, people still tell me that because I still catch myself talking to the refs too much. And I had to tell myself, leave the refs alone and the game will go your way.
Ivan Johnson and Mac Cleveland join me from San Antonio, where they'll be watching the college basketball championship game together tonight. Thanks to our colleague here, Sinq Peoples, for his help with today's story. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Art Shea is a professional photographer who has shot for the top publications and written a number of books. One of Art's better-known photographs recently made its way back into the news. It's a photo of the late French philosopher Simone de Beauvoir. Now, the January edition of the French magazine Le Nouvel Observateur ran the photo on its cover, and it generated a fair bit of controversy. That's because the photo of the French author and feminist shows her wearing nothing but a pair of high-heeled shoes. It was a picture that Art Shea took in Chicago 56 years ago, and he's joining me to explain how it came about. Art tells me that his friend was the writer Nelson Algren, and Nelson was at that time dating Simone de Beauvoir. Nelson had asked Art to do a favor for this woman that he referred to as Frenchie.
The apartment they lived in for about 3 weeks at the time was a $10 a month slum apartment. It had a one-bedroom, a kitchen, a kerosene stove. It didn't have a bathroom to speak of. That is, it had a toilet, a little cubicle, and a sink that didn't work, but it didn't have a bathtub. So he bathed in the Division Street Y, which was a few blocks away from him. But when he went there with her to bathe, they wouldn't let her in. So he asked me if I could borrow a bathtub or bathroom someplace. So Madame, that was his other name for her, so Madame could bathe. So I found one on the north side belonging to a friend of mine. So
did you not have a bathtub at your place? Did you have to go looking for someone else?
Yes, but my bathtub was 45 minutes away. This one was about 12 minutes north.
All right. So you found this apartment, and were you the one who was then going to take Simone de Beauvoir to this apartment for her bath?
Oh, I did take her from his flat. I drove her in my 49 Pontiac.
When you were driving, did you talk in the car?
Yes, we talked about one thing and another, mostly how Nelson was gambling too much. He was spending too much time playing poker. And she asked me if I were married and if I was a good husband, if I believed in fidelity, things like that.
Well, were you married?
Oh, very much so.
And were you a good husband? Did you believe in fidelity? What did you say?
Well, I think I danced a little bit around the point, and I said that most of the people I knew, most of the males I knew, had lady friends on the side. I just said I knew about her and Sartre, and her feelings were that when she was over there, she was with Sartre. When she was here, she was with Algren, and when she was anywhere else, she was a complete free spirit.
And so when you were taking her to this friend's apartment, it would be just the two of you. Was there some kind of charge in the air? Was it, you know, you're there with this elegant French intellectual. Were you thinking, you know, maybe something will happen here?
Yeah. She was very attractive. And of course, the average male self-conceit is, how would it be with this woman? But Algren was one of my best friends, and I couldn't, under any circumstances, abrogate that friendship. Although he would not have minded at all.
Art Shea is the photographer who took a picture of the author and feminist Simone de Beauvoir at the moment when she'd stepped out of her bath. Art told me that he'd been warned in advance by his friend Nelson Algren that Madame de Beauvoir liked to leave the bathroom door open.
I was sitting in the living room reading a Life magazine, and 17 feet away was a woman at a mirror combing her hair
With nothing on.
Nothing but high-heeled or semi-high-heeled shoes.
And at that moment, did you just happen by with your camera?
I always carried a camera. 80% of my waking hours, when she came out of the bath, she was at the sink fussing with her hair, and I shot several frames of her. And
did she notice you? Did she know you were taking the pictures?
Only after she heard the click of the shutter, and she said, "You naughty man." But she continued brushing her hair and then actually turned to her left and stepped into her underpants. And she got into her bra, and I, to my shame or fame as a photographer, I photographed her in those positions too.
And so your reaction was almost instinct?
I guess it was. I always, in those days and still, respond to a good picture. And
she said to you, "Oh, you naughty man." Did you get the impression at the time that she actually thought you were being naughty, or she was just joking with you.
I got the impression that she didn't give a darn, that it didn't bother her at all.
What happened after the photo was taken?
We just went back to the car, and I took her back to Algren's place.
And did you rush off and develop those negatives? What happened to them?
I developed them within a week or so. I was a very busy young photographer. And ultimately, those negatives, I thought, had gotten caught up in a flood. And then 4, 5, 6 years later, I found in a batch of negatives some that had turned orange with water immersion. But I was able to salvage the portraits of de Beauvoir, and also the nude picture was on a strip of negatives.
Tell me something, Art. Why didn't you publish those pictures at the time?
Well, A, there was no market for it. And the first time I even considered publishing it, I told the editor, he said, we can't do anything with that.
He didn't want it in the book.
No, and not for University of Illinois Press.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Art Shea did publish the image in one of his own books, never imagining that the backside of the famous writer and feminist would one day wind up on the front side of a French magazine in 2008. When that cover photo was published, there was a small protest outside the office of the magazine's editor, critics saying that the editor should put his own derriere out in public if that's the way he was going to treat such an icon of French intellectualism. I did ask Art what he thought and what Madame de Beauvoir might have thought if she'd known there'd been such a fuss.
I think she would have laughed at this whole episode, and if she had lived this long, but and if we had spoken about it, she'd have said, let's do it again. I mean, it's just, she had a wry humor about it.
Curious about something, though, Art. In your career, you've taken thousands, probably tens of thousands of photographs. At the moment when you're clicking the shutter on a picture like this, do you know there's something special about it? Or, you know, is it after the fact that something like this comes back years later?
Well, of all the photojournalists still alive and some dead, I'm probably the only one who had the only kind of possible education for this profession. I worked as a young Life staff reporter for 3 years, but I was with 15 to 20 of Life's greatest photographers. And I had occasion to stand by while they were making their pictures, and I could hear them say, hey, that was great.
I mean, look back with me. Did you know at the time that you had a kind of magical moment photograph?
I knew it was a very fine photograph. I had not a clue that it would ever be published or that it was anything but a nude picture of one of Algren's many girlfriends.
So when a photograph like this comes looping back into your life 55, 56 years after the fact, what does that tell you?
Well, it tells me that the nude photograph is never going to go out of style.
What does the photograph mean to you, Art?
It means I recorded a moment of time. I was operating at the highest level of my profession. I've devoted my life to being a photojournalist. In my life, I've done a handful of pictures that will live long after I'm gone. I think now, instead of being a well-rounded photojournalist who did over 1,000 covers, I'm the guy who took that picture of Simone de Beauvoir.
Art Shea, the photographer, joined me from Chicago. If you'd like to see that iconic photograph of his, we will have it on our website at thestory.org. And if you have an image, or a moment, or a scene from your own life that somehow captures or tells a story, I'd like to know about it. You can also get in touch with me by going to our website at thestory.org. Or you could leave me a message on our telephone line at 1-888-966-9862. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.